to the KTEP Book Club on Perspectives. I'm your host, Louis Sines. And joining us today on Perspectives is Jennifer Senior. She is a New York Times bestseller. The name of the latest book is All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Let me talk a little bit about Jennifer as well. Jennifer is a contributing editor at the New York Magazine, where she writes profiles and cover stories about politics and social science. She has been a frequent guest on NPR in numerous television programs, including Charlie Rose, The Chris Matthews Show, Hardball, Morning Joe, Washington Journal with Brian Lamb, CNN, American Morning, and NBC Today. And she's a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review. She lives in New York with her husband and young son. And, of course, now you can add KTP to your list. You're a busy lady.
I guess so. I think parents, they have a lot to say, and there seems to be a lot to say about parenthood. So, yes, I suppose it's a subject that can keep a person busy. That's true.
The book, All Joy and No Fun, it's a very intriguing title. Tell us what you mean by using this.
Yeah, no, it is a it's a very sticky title. It tends to stay with people. First of all, you should know that I had the good sense to steal it. A friend of mine used the phrase one day, and I never forgot it. I was asking him how new parenthood was, and that was his response. That's how new fatherhood was. And the distinction I just thought was so interesting and seemed to apply in so many ways, which is it is, of course, one of the most joyous things we will ever do. It provides us with these moments of transcendence that are unrivaled by any other experiences in our lives. And it gives us emotions that are, you know, unrivaled in terms of their depth and in terms of the kind of meaning that we feel. On the other hand, it seems pretty clear from data that moment to moment, parents are less happy than people without kids. And that, which is to say that there's something very stressful about raising kids, and that minute to minute, it can be extremely challenging. And so I sort of dissect the reasons why in the book. And, of course, the conclusion I come to is that it's not really about the kids, that they're not the problem, that it's something about parenting in 2015 that makes things exceptionally hard. So that's sort of where the book goes.
Jennifer, as you mentioned about 2015, some people have said that growing up in this age, they face a lot tougher situations than we ever did.
The kids say that. Is that what you're asking?
Yes. That's what they say about the kids, today's
kids. Yeah, well, and it's that may indeed be true. I mean, the answer to that is complicated because, of course, kids today have the benefit of, say, antibiotics. They have, they don't work 13-hour shifts in Dickensian, factories, right? But if you compare the kind of workload that a child has now to the workload of a child in the 1960s or 70s, they are definitely more stressed out. They definitely are more scheduled. They definitely have sort of higher academic hurdles to clear. And I think what we have to also consider with that is that the parents are, you know, concomitantly, you know, stressed out in the same way, is that, you know, a parent's stress is going to rise in tandem. If the child is overscheduled, it means the parent is overscheduled, driving them back and forth between soccer practice and violin lessons and chess and whatever else that they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. It also means that the parents are the ones who are going to be checking all of this homework and getting them tutoring and sweating all of the details of making sure that their kids are, you know, dotting all the I's and crossing all of the T's. I think the pressure has increased on both parents and children. And a lot of that is simply, you know, a straightforward fact of economics that, you know, there used to be back in the 50s and 60s not that much income inequality in the United States. But starting in the 70s, you know, middle-class wages really started stagnating. And by the 90s, the world was globalizing. And it became necessary at a certain point not just to shelter and educate your kids, but to raise this species of super child just so that your kid could get a toehold in the shrinking middle class. So that is what many parents are just struggling valiantly to do on behalf of their children these days. And that is what kids are struggling mightily with themselves, is to keep up.
Today, you see very few stay-at-home moms because, or dads, because the mother has to work. They need the second income.
That's right. So according to Pew, four in 10 mothers are the primary, if not sole, breadwinners in their households. So think about that. It's actually 41%. So 41% of the moms in this country make most of or all of the dough in their houses, which is astonishing. I mean, it's just, it's not, there's no American precedent for this. So that does a number of things, right? I mean, that, first of all, that means that we have to figure out new ways to renegotiate the division of labor at home, because we don't have any kind of domestic contracts that mirror the new kind of workforce, which is not completely saturated, but mostly saturated with women. So that creates a ton of tension at home, right? Because, I mean, we still don't know how to do this. Men and women are still fighting a lot about who does what around the house. They fight much more about this than they do about money or about sex, all the things that women's magazines tell you. It's not true. It's chores. So that's a problem, you know, and something that we're still kind of negotiating. And the other thing is that because women are working so much, they are also feeling tremendous amounts of guilt because we, of course, as a nation, are very unresolved about women working. So it means that they are furiously overcompensating by spending tons of time with their kids. The consequence of women working is not that they spend less time with their children. Paradoxically, they spend much more. What suffers is housework and cooking. You know, our houses are all filthy now, and no women know how to cook. But if you look, women are now spending more time with their kids than women did in the 1960s. Even working women spend more time with their kids than women did in the 1960s. Because in the 60s, we were cooking and we were cleaning, but we were putting our kids in playpens or telling them to go on their bicycles and not come home until 6 o'clock when we banged a gong. It's very different.
As you bring that up, but because of the income situation, a lot of these situations, the child is often brought up by someone in daycare or somebody else who's taking care of the child besides their mom. And so, as you mentioned, there's very little quality time between the mom and the child or the father and the child.
Well, actually, no. What I was saying was, in fact, the opposite. Mothers are spending more time with their kids, even though they're spending time in daycares. That this is what the paradox is, that people find it hard to wrap their minds around. But when women were at home, they weren't necessarily playing with their children. They were maintaining their homes. They were cooking, and they were cleaning, and they were entertaining, and they were volunteering. But they were sending their kids off to go play by themselves. So they were either like on their bikes and spending time with gangs of other neighborhood kids, or they were in playpens if they were tiny. They were having many more kids, so the kids were playing with each other. But mothers were not particularly intensive playmates. The irony now, and what's so weird, is that even though kids have a lot more kind of daycare situations, or they have babysitters, they have all these alternative arrangements, the funny thing is that when moms do come home, they spend all this intense time with their kids. I mean, the funny thing is that they're not neglecting their kids. They're spending less time with them. They are, in point of fact, spending more. That's the strange thing, because once they come home, it's not like what they're doing is coming home and making fancy dinners or cleaning their houses. No, no, no. What they're doing is playing with their children. And on the weekends, they're not cleaning their houses or entertaining, you know, or seeing relatives. No, they're playing with their kids. That's what's fascinating to me.
We're visiting with Jennifer Senior. Jennifer is the New York Times bestselling author, and she is the author of the recent book, All Joy and No Fun. We are discussing that about parenting, the paradox of modern parenthood. In your book, Jennifer, the chapters are broken up in six chapters: autonomy, marriage, simple gifts, concerted cultivation, adolescence, and joy. Would you mind kind of taking us through some of these steps?
Sure. So the way that I structure the book is I look at how kids affect their parents at every stage of their development, right? I'm not looking at how parents can affect their children. I'm looking at how children affect their moms and dads. So I start with the transition to parenthood itself. And the first major issue that parents contend with is that their autonomy has been sort of derailed, right? If you're a college-educated woman today, you're going to have your first baby at 30.3 years old. And if you're a college-educated man, you're going to be 32.3. So you've spent a long time on your own before having a kid now. And you're only going to have two kids. You're not going to have, like, the same number that we did back in the 60s and 50s. So the first chapter is just all about what it means to reckon with sort of in the new contours of your life, having had all of this freedom and then having to kind of trade it. So it's all about restructuring your time, your sense of identity, what it means to sort of gain ahead of steam and, you know, get into the flow of something with a child, and, you know, how. So that's chapter one. Chapter two is all about what I was referring to before. It's all about how kids affect your marriage now that they are there, right? Because your marriage is going to be different. You're going to spend less time with your spouse alone. You're going to spend more time with your children. And also, you and your spouse are going to be constantly and chronically renegotiating who does what around the house. And women and men experience their time very, very differently. So I talk all about that in chapter two. Chapter three is all about the incredibly fun joys and pleasures that little kids give you. That's what, you know, I then take a break and I say, okay, it's all really hard. Here are all these modern things that we're dealing with. But chapter three, let's just talk about what kids, when they're little, give you that's unrivaled in terms of their joy and their kind of wonderfulness. So I talk about what it means to live through your senses, to build things, because we don't do that anymore. We're so estranged. We live through computer screens. But, you know, what it means to live kind of in an uninhibited way, to, you know, dance and sing badly at the top of your lungs, all these things that kids allow us to do. Chapter four is, I call that concerted cultivation. That is a term that a sociologist came up with at the University of Pennsylvania. Her name is Annette LaRue. That's all about the years that we spend driving our kids all over creation just to cultivate them, right? We now, we're no longer our kids' doctors. We have pediatricians who do it. We're no longer growing their food. We buy that at supermarkets. We're not educating our kids. Public schools do that. Our jobs now are to cultivate our children. It's to make sure that they are college ready. Kids don't work for us anymore, and they used to. We work for them in some funny way. Like, we're the ones who are getting them college ready. So it's all about this kind of weird historical reversal where kids are no longer our economic assets. They are instead these people for whom we work, and what that means economically and in terms of our time. And then chapter five is all about the way that adolescent kids affect their parents, which is totally different from the way little kids affect their parents. I mean, the way adolescent children affect their parents is so profound. I mean, you know, it winds up being a much bigger crisis in some ways for moms and dads than it is for the adolescents themselves. You know, it's a very traumatic time for moms and dads to raise teenagers. And then chapter six is all about the overall joys that kids give a life, about, you know, that no matter how hard it is, no matter how difficult, there is just something profoundly meaningful and transcendent about raising children that, you know, it doesn't really have any other kind of life analogy. And I try and explain why those pleasures might not be so measurable by social scientists, but are deeply felt and are captured in literature and philosophy and all, you know, all these other disciplines that might not use measuring tools, but have these other kind of more beautiful and profound ways of assessing what life means.
One of the things that is starting to catch on again is homeschooling. So yeah, that's another chore for mom and dad.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so interesting. I mean, so many different people have taken it upon themselves to homeschool their kids. And it doesn't break up evenly along kind of ideological lines anymore or socioeconomic lines. People of all political affiliations and all socioeconomic stripes appear to be doing this. I mean, unless, of course, you know, you're really the poorest of the poor, then I think it's very hard. You're trying to make ends meet. But it's fascinating, and I think that it is a form of concerted cultivation, what I was saying before, where we are working so hard to cultivate our kids within an inch of their lives to make them ready for the world ahead. And people do it for a variety of reasons. They do it if they think that the public school systems around them are lacking and aren't preparing their kids adequately. They do it if they think that their kids are getting insufficient moral instruction. They do it if they think that the kids are just not interacting enough with grown-ups. They're kind of concerned about the fact that they're only getting peer-to-peer interactions, that we were just sticking kids in a box. But for whatever the reason, it makes life for parents harder. They're now doing that on top of everything else that they're doing, you know, going to work or, you know, I mean, earning their keep. They're also doing this. I mean, so it's just an extraordinary amount of work.
Tell us about the people you interviewed and if you ran into any of those, and how did that affect the child, perhaps, if you interviewed any adults?
That's right. And it's one of the major changes, really, of this century. I can't remember the exact statistic. I'm going to get it a little bit wrong. But, you know, back about 100 years ago, kids spent, I can't remember how many hours a week with grown-ups versus with kids. And it was something wildly, you know, it was like 40 hours with grown-ups and only 10 with kids or something like that. And now it's exactly the reverse. And I'm getting the numbers wrong, but it's something wildly out of proportion where kids almost only spend time with their cohort and not with grown-ups. And something has been lost in that, you know, without that intergenerational socializing. Because, you know, once you put kids together in a box, first of all, they develop their own culture, right? And it's independent from adult culture. And your kid's life suddenly becomes very mysterious to you. They're suddenly only speaking their own separate language. They've got their own separate rules, their own separate mores. They are still developing. Their brains aren't yet fully developed. The parts of their brains that are responsible for judgment aren't developed. So they are, you know, creating rules under less than ideal circumstances because they don't even have, you know, fully formed, rational, you know, executive functioning brains going. So something is really lost by not being, I think, around adults. I spent time for my book talking to parents in Minnesota in the opening chapters because they've got this great statewide program that helps parents transition to parenthood while their kids are 0 to 5 years old. 90,000 parents pass through it every year. It's this wonderful program. Then in the kind of carpool crazy years, you know, the elementary school years, I actually spend time in Texas. I'm in Texas for it. I'm in Houston and the surrounding suburbs. I'm not in El Paso, but I'm in, you know, Houston and its environs. And that was really interesting because, of course, I always thought that New York parents were kind of bananas. I'm from New York. And I didn't realize that Houston parents are also really intense. That, you know, they want their kids to be playing football and soccer and traveling teams and, you know, they get private batting coaches for baseball. I mean, they are so intense about sports in that area. And, you know, they're also competing with all these brand new kind of Asian immigrant families in the Houston area who are really excelling in, like, math and science. And so it's an amazingly intense kind of cauldron in the Houston area that I thought was very interesting and ripe for examination. And then in New York, I talked to parents who are in Brooklyn, who are mainly public school teachers. So I tried to find middle-class parents in New York who just were very reflective about what their teenagers were like.
We are visiting with Jennifer Senior. Jennifer is the New York Times best-selling author, and the latest book is All Joy and No Fun. Jennifer, when you were talking about the intense parents, I happened to run across the term a tiger mom.
Oh, yeah. Well, golly. So that was the book written by Amy Chua.
Okay.
And she called it The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom. And that was very different from my book because her book was really a polemic. It was an argument. She was trying to make the case that what you should do if you were a mother who was worth her salt is you should not allow your kids to have any sleepovers. They should only do their homework. There were only two instruments that they were allowed to play, violin or piano, and they had to play an instrument, and they had to excel at math. And she had this list of extremely harsh rules, right? I'm not like that.
I
don't tell
like
parents
that.
To do anything. I was there to observe parents and not at all to judge them. I was simply interested in how we got to this place in time. I am some ways the exact opposite of the tiger mom in the sense that, like, I'm not here to tell you what to do, and I don't judge anyone for what they do. My feeling is parenting is incredibly hard, and everybody is sort of contriving their own rules. They're making up their own rules to suit their families, whose situations are all intensely idiosyncratic. So some people are going to believe that being a tiger mom is the most appropriate thing for their families, and others are going to think it's a terrible idea, and that the best thing to do is to be a relaxed, you know, like a hands-off mom, And that if your kid wants to sit around and whittle sticks all day and that seems to work, then that's what they're going to do. I wasn't interested in championing any one point of view about how one raises one's kids. I was really looking at the way that kids affect their parents. So I was busy trying to see, wow. So, you know, I think that the tiger mom thing is like, that's her responding to all the uncertainty in the world that we're facing right now. Her answer is, okay, if we've got to go cultivate our kids, if that's the only way to get our kids ready, like, I'm going to go off and I'm going to make sure that my kid is hyper ready.
One of the things that you mentioned in your book, and actually was mentioned also in the review of the New York Times of your book, I believe you cited it, and that's how that today's kids or parents are economically worthless but emotionally priceless. I thought that was interesting.
It's the kids. Okay. So that was a sociologist. Her name was Viviana Zelzer, and she came up with this brilliant phrase, which is that kids have become economically useless but emotionally priceless. What she meant is that, you know, until very recently, kids worked, and the more kids that you had, the more the better off you were, that kids were economic assets to their families. So they worked on family farms. That was primarily where they worked. They also worked in factories and in mills and in the street trades. And it was not an ethical arrangement. You know, it was a good thing that we banned this arrangement, obviously. And we did that during the Progressive Era, so sometime between 1890 and 1920, this kind of big spate of legislation came along saying, kids cannot work. This is absolutely awful. Interestingly, farms were one of the last things that we felt that we should legislate. We still thought farm labor was really good for kids and that it built character. And the last working kids in the United States, I mean, there are still covert sweatshops and these awful arrangements, but really farm kids are sort of the last working kids in the United States in a funny way. What happened once kids stopped working is that we assigned them this very high emotional value. We said, well, they might not earn us anything, but they're unfathomably precious to us. And we are going to shelter them and make sure that we safeguard their preciousness and that we protect them from everything. And that changed the role of parents. It used to be just our role to make sure that we fed and that we clothed them, but it was their job to bring income into the house. So we had a reciprocal relationship going on. In exchange for you know, food and clothes and shelter, they brought in income. Now, you know, they don't bring in any income. In fact, they take our income. They cost us money, right? I mean, they drain money from us. You know, the average middle-class kid is going to cost their parents $300,000 to raise, and that doesn't include college. And that's not upper middle class. That's straight up middle class. So, you know, they are now draining money from the family till. So now, basically, kids lost their jobs, and parents acquired a second job. We now have a regular job, whatever that is, and we have the job of sheltering our kids and cultivating them and spending all this money on making sure that their place in the future is assured. So it's become extremely difficult for parents.
As the children grow and some of them leave the nest, and I'm sure that as you went through Texas and some of the other areas and you ran across different cultures, every family, every culture is different. Sometimes, okay, you're 18, you're out of the house. But other ones, you know, you can stay here as long as you keep providing and helping out the family. And the fact that, you know, sometimes the parents just don't want to let go.
That's right. There is that. And I think it does depend. There's another kind of variable in there, which is that today it's really hard for millennials to find jobs. You know, the recession has not been good to millennials and to kids in their 20s. So there's this phenomenon of, you know, extended adolescence, or it's the so-called extended adolescence, where, you know, or emerging adulthood, you know, whatever you want term you want to use for it, where kids are sticking around the house because they can't find anything else. And so, and also Obamacare has made it possible for kids to stay on parents' health insurance until they're 26. So, of course, we also have that. So, yes, it's going to vary from family to family. And some parents are all too eager to see their kids go. And actually, interestingly, what research tends to show is that mothers, believe it or not, even though the stereotype is that mothers have a harder time letting go, what the data tends to show is that mothers tend to be less sad when kids leave the house because they've been so stressed out all along, and they've been dealing with the emotional complexities on the ground all along, that when the kids leave, they're somewhat relieved, whereas fathers tend to be more mournful because, you know, they weren't experiencing the day-to-day stresses as much. So there's some data that talks about that. But, yeah, there are kids who are come back, and there are parents who can't let go, and, you know, there's lots of interesting data showing that parents and kids are texting all the time when the kids are at college. But, of course, kids text everyone. You know, they don't just text their parents.
So what about that, Jennifer? Because we used to watch the Waltons. They all sit down at the family table, eat dinner. Gosh, even Opie and Aunt Bea and Andy get together. But now, it's as you, in your book, you mentioned that homework time is now the new family dinner time.
I know. So it's really kind of sad. It's a little perverse that I think that what family time has come to mean is often that time spent in the car going to soccer practice or the time hovering over a particularly difficult math problem. And yes, I was quoting a Texas mom who her dining room table was never used for eating, right? I mean, if it was used for takeout because she, like a lot of mothers, worked, didn't cook, came home with plastic styrofoam containers. But what that dining room table was used for was homework. And there were school supplies all over that table. And I totally get it. There are school supplies all over ours, too. I mean, we also eat at it, but that's because my husband cooks. You know, I mean, so there's a, you know, I mean, he's the far better, the far superior cook between the two of us. But, you know, the homework really is, you know, the new family dinner for, I think, a lot of families. So here's what families don't do anymore. We don't tend to visit with other families as much. We don't tend to visit with our neighbors as much. We don't tend to even be involved in our religious communities as much. We spend a lot of time doing a lot of homework and a lot of soccer practice and a lot of making our kids practice the piano. And, you know, I do meditate at the end of that chapter. It'd be so interesting. What would happen if dinner were the new family dinner, you know? Or what would happen if instead of us spending all this time on tutors or hovering over our kids, we were actually volunteering in soup kitchens, you know, because our civic participation has gone down over the last few decades. So, you know, if instead of hovering over our kids, we were actually saying, let's all pile into the car and go do, you know, volunteer work. But we do less of, I mean, you know, something else suffers, I think, because we're so anxious to make sure that our kids are kind of future ready.
Jennifer, as we're wrapping up the program here, do you have a website or a particular page that our listeners can go to find out more about your book and about, you know, some of the things that you've talked about?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for asking. It's very simple. It's JenniferSenior.com. It's my name with a .com at the end.
Okay. And it's senior like S-E-N-I-O-R, not S-R, right?
Yes, like the year in high school. That is my last name. And okay. I, you know, we could spend forever puzzling over how that happened, but it is indeed my last name.
Jennifer, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
We've been visiting with Jennifer Senior. Jennifer is a New York Times bestselling author. Her latest book is All Joy and No Fun. And if you want to find out more about Jennifer's book or some of the other things that she's done, you can go to JenniferSenior.com. JenniferSenior.com. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Department. Our producer is DJ Orozco. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.